Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, books on insects. With us is Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and biologist Dennis Minsky from Provincetown. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Mindy. Good morning, Dennis.
Jill, good morning, Mindy.
So, books that feature insects. This was your idea, Dennis.
Yep.
And so, why?
I don't know. we just had covered other, you know, fish, birds, whales.
So insects seem like a logical.
It did. Yeah. And I would like to say that when we did decide on insects, I had no idea. Since we decided on insects, there's been major news about the what is called the insect apocalypse, which is anywhere from 50 to 75% reduction in insect population, insect numbers across habitats, developed land, nature land.
Do we know why?
Well, all the usual suspects. And for all those listeners who are saying good.
No, it's not good.
We take for granted the services that insects provide us. So
We're doomed without insects.
Yes, we wouldn't last a week, according to E.O. Wilson.
Yeah, who's going to pollinate our you know, vegetables
and who's going to get rid of our garbage?
All that.
So this is a very timely, and 60% of birds eat insects. So very timely, it turns out to be, and I didn't know.
So some of the reason is you know, just like the amount of insecticides and things like that.
All
is that,
that
a big player?
Yes, yeah. Climate change, of course.
Climate change,
development, agriculture, and more.
Yeah, so we always talk about, you know, getting our yards more bird-friendly and maybe sometimes pollinator-friendly. We might want to start thinking about creating some habitat for some of these
Absolutely.
Insects,
All right.
Well, and I have to say the first thing that Dennis taught me before we got on the air here is a couple of weeks ago, I was writing to him about, you know, what insects we might cover. And one of the things I discovered was, thanks to Dennis, that neither spiders nor ticks are insects.
That's right. Yeah.
Is that not correct, Dennis?
That is correct. You know, there's one other thing I would say before we talk about books. A few days ago, a man named Homero Gomez Gonzalez went missing, presumed murdered. Gonzalez was a warden, a conservation a person who protected the monarch butterfly wintering grounds in Mexico.
Oh, dear.
And he had been repeatedly threatened by the illegal logging operations that are going there. He had given his presumably has given his life to protect the monarch butterfly. And he joins dozens of other people around the world in Asia, in Indonesia, in South America, who have been killed, many of them indigenous people, protecting. So while we sit and go to committee hearings and talk about the environment, there are people giving their lives, and in this case, for the monarch butterfly. So I dedicate this conversation to Gonzalez.
All right, so let's learn a little bit then about some reading that we can bring ourselves up to date on insects. And what's your first book, Dennis?
Well, it's hard to choose, but my first book will be Journey to the Ants by a personal hero of mine, E.O. Wilson, Edward O. Wilson, co-written with Bert Holdobler, who's a German biologist. Terrific book, very full of scientific facts, but also very accessible. He starts, "We entered our bug period as children and were blessed by never being required to abandon it." And it's about ants. Ants are arguably the most successful animal on Earth. Now, don't ask me how they figured this out, but if you weighed all the ants in the world, and all the people in the world, they would be even. So why are they so successful? I'll talk about this with bees, too. But they're successful because they're social. And I don't mean social the way we are. I mean eusocial, truly social. They live in societies with divisions of labor. Wilson says, one ant is a disappointment. It is really no ant at all. The ant, you can only think of an ant as a colony. He says Karl Marx got it right. He just picked the wrong organism. Socialism works. And what do? They're the chief predators in the animal world for little things. They collect 90% of all dead things and waste. They transport seeds. They affect the distribution of plants. And they move more soil than earthworms. One colony moved 44 tons of soil.
Wow.
But they are mean little guys. Yeah. He says, ants are arguably the most aggressive and warlike of all animals. They far exceed human beings in organized nastiness. Our species is, by comparison, gentle and sweet-tempered.
Imagine. Oh, my.
The foreign policy aim of ants can be summarized as follows: restless aggression, territorial conquest, and genocidal annihilation of neighboring colonies whenever possible. If ants had nuclear weapons, they would probably end the world in a week.
Wow.
And he also says, and get this, while human societies send their young men to war, ants send their old ladies. Because, of course, they're all females.
Right.
The queen's a female. All the workers are female. There are a few males that are briefly around. But he calls the army ants the grim reapers of the tropical forest. They clear the length of a football field every day.
That's amazing.
Anything.
Yeah.
So amazing is exactly what this is. These are incredible creatures, and they'll be here long after we are, he says.
So what's the name of the book again?
It's called Journey to the Ants, and I highly recommend it. Mm-hmm. Very good read. Anybody who's even vaguely interested will find a lot of amazing. I only barely got started on it.
All right, Jill.
Well, I took a very different approach than Dennis to this topic, not surprisingly. And I, as with so many of these shows, start by thinking, like, what was the first book I ever read about, whatever topic it is, to try to connect it with my own reading life and my own reading history. And of course, the book that I remembered most strongly from my childhood in terms of insects was The Cricket in Times Square by George Selden, with these fabulous drawings by Garth Williams. It is indeed about a cricket who comes to Times Square. It has a sweet, sweet story about the cricket coming to being found by a boy at a newsstand. And he gets to the city, and of course, the city he has come from, the country, it's a much different place. And here's a little bit from about Tucker Mouse, who is one of the people, as it were, that meets him once he gets to this newsstand. And I will also say that I was surprised. Well, we'll get to this, but I was surprised that, in fact, there are people that, in this book, it's all about this cricket giving concerts. But in fact, I found evidence that, in fact, there have been cricket concerts. So here's Tucker Mouse. Now, Tucker Mouse had heard almost all the sounds that can be heard in New York City. He had heard the rumble of subway trains and the shriek their iron wheels make when they go around a corner. From above, through the iron grills that open onto the streets, he had heard the thrumming of the rubber tires of automobiles and the hooting of their horns and the howling of their brakes. And he had heard the babble of voices when the station was full of human beings and the barking of the dogs that some of them had on leashes, birds, the pigeons of New York and cats, and even the high purring of airplanes above the city. Tucker had heard. But in all his days and on all his journeys through the greatest city in the world, Tucker had never heard a sound quite like this one. And this is where he meets the cricket. And the cricket becomes a huge success and is giving concerts and gets some training from the local Chinese community who worship the crickets, and the cricket lives his life in the newsstand for some time. But of course, at the end of the book, the cricket has to go home, as so many people do in children's stories. They need to return home. But he learns a lot about city life while he's there. It's a really sweet story. It has really beautiful illustrations. It holds up surprisingly well, having read it a very long time ago and just recently reread it. And it is a great tale to either read aloud with a kid or to read yourself. It is called The Cricket in Times Square by George Selden.
Now, if you have thoughts this morning for books you'd like to suggest featuring insects, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I have one book to contribute to the conversation this morning. It's called The Smaller Majority by Peter Nesrecki, and he is an entomologist, photographer, and author based at the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard University. This is a book a little bit older. It's from 2005, and the description, smaller on average than a human finger, creatures climbing, scampering, and flying out of sight make up 99% of all animal life visible to the naked eye. What's interesting about this book is the camera techniques. So he's using pioneering camera techniques that allow us to see the world of these creatures from their point of view. The book exposes the environment in which they live, the threats they face, and the devastating impact their disappearance may have. It is a really marvelous book with beautiful photographs and really gives us, like I said, that view. And he is the insect he is most fascinated with is katydids, which I learned a lot when I read that book. It's like an encyclopedia of insects. So I would recommend The Smaller Majority by Peter Nesrecki. All right, Dennis, what's your next book?
Well, I talked about ants. I'll talk about bees. A book called A Honeybee Democracy by Thomas Seeley, 2010. So most bees, there are about over 20,000 kinds of bees, by the way. And most bees are loners. We think about bees living in colonies, hives. Most bees are loners. But this is about the honeybee, which is a European bee, which is now all over the United States. But honeybees live in hives. Now, a hive, like an ant colony, is a superorganism. This is a scientific term. It's a composite being that functions as a whole. Now, the queen, and this is true for ants as well, the queen is not the leader. The queen simply lays eggs. There's no decision-making process by an individual. It's done by the colony or the hive. Now, when a hive, so just a quick recap. When a hive gets big enough, it splits. And if John Portnoy is listening, he can truth this. A swarm goes out. Now, a swarm of bees weighs about 2 pounds or 3 pounds, which is about, he talks of 3 pounds of bees in a swarm, 3 pounds of neurons in a human brain. Mm. So the swarm is hanging there. It's got the queen. And I back up. In the 1950s, a guy named Von Frisch discovered that the waggle dance, bees can communicate the source of good flowers by the position, the direction and the distance to a flower. And they go back to the hive and communicate this. They really do this. It's an amazing discovery. Well, the same thing happens when these swarms have to find a new hive. They have to find a new hive. Now, they have real estate preferences. Height, size of the entrance hole, volume of the cavity. These are really important. 25% of all hives fail over the winter. So these are important. So the scouts go out. About 10,000 bees, about 400 of them are scouts. They go out and look for these new sites. They come back, they do a waggle dance, and based on their dance, the duration and the frequency of all these movements, they recruit other bees who then go out and look at that site. So you have these competing scouts, and they achieve consensus. These are bees.
That's amazing.
And he likens it, his whole chapter on New England town meetings and how the very same process. But to me, it even more reminded me of what's coming up, the Iowa caucus. Mm-hmm. You guys go over in that corner if you're for that person, that corner for that person. And eventually, they come up with a choice. But we have a bunch of bees that make a choice collectively. A honeybee democracy by Thomas Seeley. Shocking. Yeah. Good book.
And Jenny's recommending The Dancing Bees by Carl von Frisch. She says it's a classic, another one to add to our list. You're listening to The Point today. It's books on insects, books featuring insects. With us is Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and biologist Dennis Minsky from Provincetown. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Eric is giving us a call from Woods Hole. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. I spend most of my time with spiders, but having a lot of time with my ecological father, we also spent a lot of time censusing the butterflies in the 80s and 90s. But I wanted to mention, in this slightly more technical world, not terribly technical, but there's now, for the first time in the last few years, a field guide to the ants of New England.
Oh.
Done by people, some of them are in the region most of the time. One of the authors is Gary Alpert, who did a lot of photographs up at Harvard, and Aaron Ellison, Nicholas Gotell, and Elizabeth Farnsworth. So there actually is now a field guide to the ants of New England for the first time.
Yeah, that's great. That's great to know, Eric. Yeah,
you
know,
and nice to hear from you, Eric.
Yeah. Well, what's fun about that is, you know, sometimes I think about the own ants I have in my backyard, and my grandson's fascinated with ants. So that's a great thing to have on hand for the kids, right?
Yeah. You need a loop, and you need to take specimens, but that's definitely a plus. You know, as we have field guides for everything, but we've never.
Yeah.
So there's also slightly less useful to the locals, but still interesting is there's an Ants of North America, which mm-hmm. is a guide to the genera of ants. And that's pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
Smaller.
Right.
The other two, one is For Love of Insects by Thomas Eisner, loaded okay. with incredible photographs, which he takes, with a foreword by E.O. Wilson. And then another one, which comes in paperback by Lang Elliott and Will Hirschberger, and includes a CD called The Songs of Insects.
The Songs. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Eric, thanks. Those are some great suggestions. Yeah, thanks for calling. Appreciate that. 866-999-4626. If you have some suggestions for books featuring insects to add to our list, Ian writes, Ahoy Pointers. Great topic. I see you had the good taste to resist the obvious alliteration, and I'm sure you'll get to Kafka. No, we're not, right? Nobody brought Kafka.
We held back on Kafka, but feel free to call in if you'd like to say something
I meant
about
to,
it.
I meant to get to it.
We both had it as a possibility.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Okay, and Lee writes in, Lee missed the beginning of the show because she says she'd mentioned Charlotte's Web. But that's about a spider.
That was the book I wanted to talk about. But Charlotte's a spider.
She's
unfortunately,
not an insect,
it's still a great.
It
book.
Is.
It is.
Great,
it
yes,
is.
I was gonna. That we'll mention it just because that was the very first book that actually, as a child, you know, you read all these little. That was the book that really I went. You know, that's the brings you to a different world, right? You know,
right, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill.
Well, the next book I have, Dennis has gotten very serious about all our insects, and I understand why. However, I found one of the funniest books I've ever read, which is called Sex on Six Legs by Marlene Zuck. And amazingly, the subtitle being Lessons on Life, Love, and Language from the Insects World. And amazingly to me, because I went back and looked, it got great reviews, the only library on the Cape and Islands that has a copy of this is the Edgartown Public Library. So,
oh,
you know,
really?
Put your hold in right now. I'm trying to get a copy, but it's out of print, apparently. And in her introduction, she starts with a quote by Joseph Crutch, which says, "Two-legged creatures we are supposed to love as we love ourselves. The four-legged also can come to seem pretty important, but six legs are too many from the human standpoint." And her first paragraph begins, "People are more afraid of insects than they are of dying, at least if you believe a 1973, now they may have done a more recent survey, 73 survey published in the Book of Lists. Only public speaking and heights exceeded the six-legged as sources of fear, although financial problems and deep water, presumably when one was immersed in it, tied with insects at number three. Dying came in at number six.
Wow.
So, she talks a lot about all of these different insects. One of the reviewers in the New York Times said, in the realm of insects, unlike in the realm of mammals, say there's plenty of room at the bottom, room for millions of species and quintillions of individuals to coexist, mm-hmm. and room for biologists to make significant discoveries about them by peering closely at their behaviors and their brains. In Sex on Six Legs, the biologist Marlene Zuck argues that insects, because they are both unlike us and, in surprising ways, like us, provide excellent fodder for studying the relative value of inheritance versus environment, the evolution of personality, the definition of language, and the downside of growing bigger brains. The antithesis of the dispassionate scientist Zuck, who teaches at the University of California, Riverside, waxes exuberant over insects not for their extraordinary looks or the billion-dollar ecosystem services they provide, like pollination and nutrient recycling, but for the often bizarre things they do to get ahead. And they quote from her, things that would put the most gruesome horror film to shame. Mm. So you learn a lot about bugs and what they do in this. And she writes, insects are equal opportunity. Insects are great equalizers. There is not a corner of the globe where people, rich, poor, old, or young, have not had some encounter with insects, even if only to swat a mosquito or crush a cockroach. Because of that ubiquity, insects are the easiest portal to the animal kingdom, an inadvertent reminder that other creatures live here besides us, whether we want them to or not. We are all in the same buzzing, crawling boat. And she talks about growing up in this L.A., a suburb of L.A., where there weren't many creatures, but what she did have, and her family didn't have a lot of money, but what they did have were insects everywhere. Mm. So there were ants she could study, there were butterflies she could, you know, there are all these things that any kid can start studying because it's everywhere. So it's really a fun book, and you learn more than you can imagine about insects. And there's also a whole section about the Bee Movie, which apparently she hated because it says in Bee Movie, Jerry Seinfeld plays a slacker honeybee yearning for a life beyond the tedium of the factory. His portrayal of a social insect as male is as glaring in its inaccuracy as in its ubiquity. No one, including me, expects movies to be faithfully accurate in all their details, but there are errors and errors. Poetic license versus jarring ineptitude, bloopers versus downright stupidity. You get an idea of her tone in this book. Talking animals is one thing, but getting it wrong about honeybees is on a par with portraying astronauts in a universe where the Earth revolves around the sun, or TV doctors who are worried about anemia due to a lack of lead in the blood instead of iron. So she goes on at great length about bees in here and what they do. But it's what I love about this book is that it is very funny, and also you're getting a lot of information about insects in it. Sex on Six Legs by Marlene Zuck.
All right, let's talk to Laura, giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Mindy. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a book that I would love to recommend that my sister, who is a biologist turned science teacher, actually got the CD for us when my kids were really young. We used to take car trips and we'd listen to books on tape. So we'd listen to this one, and my kids still, now that they're teenagers, still occasionally bring it up. But it's called The City Under the Back Steps by Evelyn Lampman. Mm-hmm. And it's adorable. It's about two kids who, I think it's during summer vacation, they get shrunken down and end up in this city, which is an ant city under the back steps. But the ants don't really talk. They speak to them through their antenna. But I think a lot of it is portrayed, you know, accurately in terms of what goes on in the ant world.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But very well done. My kids loved it.
Okay. So is it the City Under the Steps? Was that the name again?
City Under the Back Steps.
City Under the Back Steps. So thanks for that, Laura. Appreciate that.
That's good.
You made me think of another kids' book series for really younger kids, Ant and Bee. Do you know that series, Jill? It's they're small format hardback books written by Angela Banner. And she began writing the books in order to teach her son how to read. But there's the reading ones. The first book is about how the ant and bee meet. And they go through the alphabet of these boxes looking for their missing hats. And then there's also some that are with numbers. And they're a lot of fun, especially for those pre-readers getting ready to learn how to read. So Ant and Bee. All right, Dennis, what's next?
The Mosquito, a brand new book by Timothy Wingard. This is a monumental book. I say that with everyone, but this is up there with Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond. Those of you who – this is a look at human history as influenced by mosquito. And he says, the mosquito has killed more people than any other cause of death in human history. Half of all humans that have ever lived, 52 billion, how they figured this out, I don't know, have been killed by mosquitoes. Mosquitoes, the ultimate agent of historical change, she has played a greater role in shaping our story than any other animal with which we share our global village. And here's a list. I won't even go into each of these, but the Bantu in Africa, the Peloponnesian War, the Huns, the Vandals, the rise of Christianity, the Crusades, Genghis Khan, a whole chapter called the Columbian Exchange, which is Columbus and the other Europeans coming to this continent. Now, there were mosquitoes in America, but they didn't have malaria and they didn't have other diseases. It was European people bringing over 90% of Native Americans exterminated by, among other things, mosquitoes. And then the slavery trade, Revolutionary War, dissolution of the Spanish Empire, the Civil War. Mosquitoes are called the Third Army in the Civil War. Spanish-American War, Vietnam War. He writes, with her blood-tip proboscis, the mosquito was writing the unforgiving finale. The mosquito deserves a place on Mount Rushmore with her protuberant face tucked in between the grateful glances of the indebted Washington and Jefferson. Eight presidents from Washington to Kennedy have had malaria. And he says, even in the face of modern science and medicine, she remains the most hazardous animal to humankind. A million people a year. Sadly, you can guess where.
Mosquitoes carry a lot, don't they?
Yeah. At just how they shaped our history, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Major book.
Again, the name is?
The Mosquito.
The Mosquito.
Timothy Wingard, who is actually a military historian.
Oh, interesting.
And his other books are about various aspects of military history. And there's a lot of that in here.
Yeah, great. Thanks.
Good book.
Well, here's a way we can use insects that we might not have thought of previously. This book is called Edible, an adventure into the world of eating insects and the last great hope to save the planet by Daniela Martin. The author's interest in eating insects began when she was studying pre-Columbian food and medicine in Mexico, where she intentionally ate her first bug. Later, she read a galvanizing article detailing a bug cook-off between insect chefs in Virginia. Quote, the article discussed new research on insects as a possible global food source, a potential solution to world hunger, and an eco-friendly alternative to beef and other livestock, which I've never heard of.
Unless you're hiding those bugs somewhere in there, I'd starve.
Well,
yeah.
She says in her introduction, this book is about eating bugs, for real. And if you make it all the way through the book, you're going to want to taste the revolution for yourself, which, as with Mindy, I find this hard to believe. She continues, why? Eating bugs makes sense. Ecological, nutritional, economic, global and culinary sense. Yes, they even taste good. Many people disdainfully say they don't like bugs, are afraid of them, or are repelled by them on some deep subconscious, yet stridently self-righteous level. But like them, or not, insects are the largest terrestrial biomass on Earth. That means of all the animals that live on dry land, insects are most of them. If someone were to determine by the numbers what Earth was about, they would conclude insects, beetles mostly. So, you know, I don't know that I'm up for it, but it's she basically deconstructs the various tastes and textures encountered while munching on insects. For example, crickets are nutty. Bee larvae resemble bacon. I don't believe it. Giant water bugs emit the scent of a crisp green apple. And she concludes, helpful tips for raising bugs at home, an essential list of edible insects, cooking basics, and recipes for preparing a bugs and crickety kale salad. Now, you know, that maybe wax moth tacos, salty sweet wax worms. So if you are interested in expanding your food horizons, or if you currently are eating bugs and you need some more recipes, this book is for you. It's called Edible by Daniela Martin.
You know what? I'm going to, you know, Dennis talked about the decline in our insect population. I'm not going to eat any bugs.
Well, you're doing the right thing.
That's
huh?
right. I'm going to save bugs.
You happen to be in the minority in the world. Many
I'm
people.
I'm sure.
And I also, just to chime in here, a pound of beef in one of my books requires 1,000 gallons of water and 2 acres of grazing area.
Right.
A pound of crickets requires 1 gallon of water and 2 cubic feet of grazing area, and they feed on food waste.
Yeah.
So they're
There's a point there, for sure.
They talk about being the new sushi. You know, people didn't eat sushi so long ago.
Yeah, that's true.
And the chiming in on the beetles, how many beetles there are. Another book I read, not the one I want to talk about, but just briefly, in the late 19th century, a cleric asked this famous geneticist, based on God's creation, what can you say about God? And he, without a hitch, he said, he has an inordinate fondness for beetles. There's 350,000 different kinds of beetles.
Maybe chocolate covered. I don't know. Maybe.
Well, they grind them up.
All right. Nelson Michel wrote in. He said, Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis from 1915 might be worth a mention. Not that Kafka is everyone's favorite morning read, but it portrays a character awakening as a gigantic insect. He missed the first 15 minutes, so if Kafka's already been mentioned, my apologies. Sort of, but we didn't get into any
details. We acknowledged it, and we didn't.
Let's talk to Joanne, who's calling from Wellfleet. Good morning, Joanne.
Hi, I have a children's book.
Okay.
And having been a children's librarian for many years, I still read children's books. This is by Elise Broach, B-R-O-A-C-H, who I had not heard of before. The title is Masterpiece. It's about an 11-year-old boy in an apartment in New York, and he gets as a present a pen and ink drawing set, and he doesn't know quite what to do with it. He puts it on his desk and opens everything up so that he can get an idea of what this package contains. And then that night, Marvin, a beetle who lives in the kitchen, somehow is drawn there and starts looking at this pen and the ink and starts just picking up the pen somehow. No, he doesn't pick up the pen. He dips his finger, so to speak, into this ink that has been opened, and he starts noodling on the paper and gets really fascinated with what he's doing. The next morning, the mother comes in to wake her son, and she sees this little drawing and says, oh, my God, I had no idea that he was anywhere inclined toward this that much. And, well, the whole thing is everybody is just blown away with this great art. And the boy doesn't really, can't say, well, I didn't do it. And it goes on to get very renowned, and he just doesn't know what to do about it, and he's worried very much about their saying, oh, do another one. And so the beetle is able to do a couple, and they finally take, the boy takes the beetle to the Metropolitan, where they look at some other pen and ink drawings, and he brings the beetle underneath his collar, very carefully giving him a good view of works by such as Albrecht Dürer. And, well, the whole thing gets very complicated for him and for the beetle, and it's just a wonderful book. Mm-hmm. It's an ALA notable children's book set. Great. So I'm not the only one.
You're not the only one in love with it. Joanne, thanks for that suggestion. We'll put that
Sounds
on our list.
Great.
Thanks so much for calling. You're listening to The Point. Today it's books featuring insects. With us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and biologist Dennis Minsky from Provincetown. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. This is from Eleanor. She says, although I'm a fine artist, Rosemary Wells, the children's book author, urged me to illustrate one of her books, The Fisherman and His Wife. The setting was a simple cabin in the mountains, and I had submitted certain interior drawings, which included spiders in a web. The publishing house's picture editor called me to discuss pictorial content and said she was sending the drawings back. Please, no bugs and no mice. In the 4 years it took to illustrate that book, I managed to slip in a few creatures, but they had to have gentle colors so parents and grandparents wouldn't consider the book scary and therefore not buy it. As a fine artist, no one tells me not to paint bugs. They're 1,000 times more fascinating than television. And, you know, that's interesting that they would do that, because kids are usually really interested in bugs, you know? I mean,
they're smaller than they are, for
one
thing.
Yeah, exactly. And then we have another email from Dale, who says, after listening to my husband say, listen to this multiple times each time he sits down to read this book, I have to recommend it to you. Bringing Nature Home by Douglas W. Tallamy. Douglas Tallamy presents a powerful and compelling illustration of how the choices we make as gardeners can profoundly impact the diversity mm-hmm. of life in our yards, our town, and our planet. This important work should be required reading for anyone who ever puts a shovel to the earth. I can't wait till my husband finishes this book so I can read it. All right, so that's great. Thank you for that. And then Barbara is calling from Dennis. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. It's nice to be on your program. I love your book shows. I don't know. I missed a few minutes, so I don't know if this has been mentioned already, but Flight Behavior by Barbara Kingsolver.
No, it has not been mentioned.
Oh, great book. I read that book.
Yeah, Monarch Butterflies, and it's a metaphor for the female protagonist in the book. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a beautiful book.
Right.
It is, right. She discovers a new wintering ground for the monarch butterfly in, correct me if I'm wrong, Virginia or North Carolina or somewhere that no one had ever known before. Mm-hmm. It's really neat. It is a neat book.
Yeah, Barbara, thanks for that suggestion.
And it changes her life for the better.
Yeah. Great. Thank you for that. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Dennis, what's next?
I forgot about that book. That was a good book. Actually, I want to talk about butterflies. I have a book called The Last Butterflies, A Scientist's Quest to Save a Rare and Vanishing Creature by Nick Haddard, Haddard, 2019 book. There are, I don't know, I think, I can't quite read, 11 or 14,000 species of butterflies. Of course, you know, they're still discovering insects like crazy. There are a lot of butterflies, but there are many that are endangered. And I already mentioned the decrease in numbers of insects overall. Butterflies are sharing that fate. So this book is about scientists looking for the most endangered and in fact, extinct butterflies. And the reasons for all these, for the drop in numbers, the usual culprits, but here also is a new one to consider, and that is the loss of natural disturbance. And we think about establishing a conservation area and then it's safe. But in fact, nature needs disturbance, and sometimes we save it to death. He talks about fire suppression. He talks about dune stabilization. I'll give you one example. There's a beautiful butterfly called the St. Francis's Satyr. It's found only on Fort Bragg, military base.
Wow.
Only on the artillery range. The artillery fire causes fires, which suppress vegetation, which allows these butterflies to live. They used to rely on beavers, but the beavers all got killed out. So they need that fire. Now, here's another one. The British large blue, officially extinct in 1979. That butterfly depend. This is how complicated things are. That butterfly depended on one species of ant. The ant raised the caterpillars. The ants depended on low grass. That was dependent on rabbits. And they got rid of all the rabbits, got rid of all the ants, got rid of the butterflies. So it's complicated. He says many endangered species are conservation reliant. There's this whole chapter on monarch butterflies. They are not endangered, but they have had an 87% decrease in the east and a 97% decrease in the west. And then the most sobering thing is he talks about a species being functionally extinct, and that is a species ceases to exist in an ecosystem long before the last individual dies. And we can think about our North Atlantic right whales, and right. I don't know what Stormy Mayo would say, but if you don't have enough of the species to fulfill the niche services, then it's already gone. So, but this is a beautiful book, very well written, and lots of people dedicating their lives. In all these books, people dedicating their lives to studying these insects.
So you mentioned butterflies. There's a book I'm really looking forward to coming out in May from a local author, Wendy Williams, and it's The Language of Butterflies. So I'm really anxious to see that. She wrote a great book about horses, and I'm really looking forward. That won't be out until May, so we're not going to put it on the list, because, but we're definitely going to be looking for that. And when that book comes out, we definitely are going to want to talk to Wendy about that. What's next?
Well, speaking of butterflies, I've brought what is a children's book, but as many of you know, you can learn a lot from children's books. This is called The Girl Who Drew Butterflies, How Maria Marion's Art Changed Science. Maria Sibylla Marion lived from 1647 to 1717 and did this for the study of insects what pioneering fossil hunter Mary Anning did for paleontology and egg collector and scientific illustrator Genevieve Jones did for ornithology. She was one of the most important contributors to the field of entomology in the history of science. And one of the fabulous things about this book is that you can learn, as an adult, you will learn a lot also about what it is to collect butterflies, to illustrate butterflies. And one of the fabulous things is that if none of you know what the Biodiversity Heritage Library is, it is an online resource, which I'll put a link to up on our web, where you can see lots of her illustrations, which are spectacular. And for a young woman to be able to do this and to read about it, it's a wonderful story about science before photography. And so I would highly recommend The Girl Who Drew Butterflies, How Maria Marion's Art Changed Science by Joyce Sidman. It's a beautiful book, and you will learn a lot.
All right. Let's talk to Sid calling from Harwich. Hi, Sid.
Hi. Hi.
Yep. Go ahead, Sid.
My knowledge of insects is not so wonderful. Is a cockroach an insect?
Yep.
It is.
Yep.
Well, there is a book called Archie and Mehitable.
I am so glad you're mentioning that book, because that's in my pile of books. Continue on.
Well, that's it. You probably could tell people more.
No, go ahead.
I read it when I was a teenager, and it's just kind of wonderful about this cockroach who throws himself against the keys of a typewriter at a reporter's desk and tells these wonderful stories about other animals, especially Mehitabel, the cat who thinks that she used to be Cleopatra.
It's such a fabulous... Here's a little taste of one of his poems about fleas. "I heard a couple of fleas talking the other day," says one. "Come to lunch with me. I can lead you to a pedigreed dog," says the other one. "I do not care what a dog's pedigree may be. Safety first is my motto. What I want to know is whether he's got a muzzle on millionaires and bums taste about alike to me. Insects have their own point of view about civilization. A man thinks he amounts to a great deal, but to a flea or a mosquito, a human being is merely something good to eat." It's great fun, Archie and Mehitabel.
Yeah. All right. Sid, thanks for calling and thanks for that suggestion. Did you guys have something you wanted to read, of a poem or something?
Shall we do?
Yeah.
We have one. If
yeah.
we have Can time,
I, yeah,
we
go.
Have.
Go I just want to mention one other fact, because we're into this not eating insects. But I just want to remind everybody that if you like a nice spoonful of honey, that is basically a bee vomit.
Okay. Thanks, Dennis.
Regurgitated from the bee. So just a reminder.
We did bring with us was a poem from a collection called Joyful Noise, Poems for Two Voices by Paul Fleischman. And the one we're going to read for you, which these are poems that you read, you need two people to read them. It's called Book Lice. Dennis, you begin.
"I was born in a fine old edition of Schiller.
While I started life in a private eye thriller.
We're
book lice who
dwell
in these dusty
bookshelves. Later I lodged in Scott's work, volume 50.
While I passed my youth in an Agatha Christie. We're book lice attached despite contrasting past.
Sorry about that. One day, while in search of a new place to eat,
he fell down seven shelves where we happened to meet.
We're
book lice who chew
on
the bookbinding glue.
We honeymooned in an old guidebook on Greece.
I missed Conan Doyle. He pined for his Keats.
We're
book lice, fine mates,
despite different tastes. So we set up our home inside Roger's thesaurus.
Not far from my mysteries, close to his Horace.
We're book lice
adoring despite his loud snoring.
And there we've resided, and there we'll remain.
He near by his Shakespeare, I near my Spillane.
We're
book-loving book lice, plain proof
of the
fact.
Which I'm certain I read in a book some months back.
That opposites often are known to attract. That's from Joyful Noise, Poems for Two Voices by Paul Fleischman, illustrated by Eric Beddoes.
And so this is the whole book is poems for two people?
The whole book is poems for two voices, and it's a really fun thing to do with kids as well as adults. The poems were written to be read aloud by two readers at once, and one takes the left-hand part, the other one takes the right-hand part, and the poems should be read from top to bottom. The
and
two
one
parts
should rehearse
meshing
a little
as in a musical duet.
Yeah. And, of course, we will have a link to all the books that we talked about this morning. A little bit later this afternoon, Jill puts that together for us. She's going to collect all of the suggestions we had this morning.
Of which we had many
So we will have a link to that up on our website, capeandislands.org. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Dennis Minsky, biologist from Provincetown. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you,
Thank
Mindy.
Thank you. It was fun.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.